I think Anita was referring to a group called the Waldensians. They were heavily persecuted in France in the 13th, 14th century, founded by a man by the name of Peter Waldo. And there are still Waldensian churches in America and other places. They later merged with the Reformation and are part of that Protestant tradition. But they were heavily persecuted. Where we are together is we're in the book of Daniel, and Daniel is divided, I think, into two parts. In chapters 1 to 6, you have instances of God's protection for our Lord's people. And then beginning in chapter 7, yeah, we're at 8 today, you have the visions of Daniel. And Daniel receives visions of the future. And as you read these several, I think there are four, visions, they're reoccurring themes. And so I think the way to speak to the issue is to focus on chapter 2, looking down into the future. And they disturb Daniel because the text doesn't say so, but there's a recurring refrain that Daniel thinks that because the people have suffered in exile and the return is coming, because he's living in the days of the beginning of the reign of Cyrus the Persian, and the people will be allowed to return, that a great day is immediately coming. And it's clear from the visions that there's a distant future of his coming, and the interim is not always pleasant. And David, I think Daniel just struggles with that, like we all do. Why is he taking so long? So when you come to chapter 2, you have a vision of four kingdoms that are delivered in the form of a statue for Nebuchadnezzar. He has that vision, not Daniel. And when you're finished with chapter 2, we are told that they represent four kingdoms. The head is Nebuchadnezzar of gold. There's a decreasing quality in these kingdoms. The chest is Medo-Persia, a coalition of kings that toppled the Babylonian Empire. The hips are, I think, something like that. Stomach is bronze, and it is Greece and Alexander the Great, a succession of mighty empires. And the fourth is Rome, the Roman Empire, that really bespeaks of the entire era of the time of the Gentiles. That kingdom will be divided. It's iron. Its toes are a mixture of iron and clay. So it's just a vision. But at the period of the iron and the clay, a stone cut from heaven will crush the image. And that image, or that stone, uncut, not made of man, from heaven is the Lord. So what is being said is that when the end of time comes, Christ will conclude it. And after that will be that kingdom that we all look forward to. I think that's the point of chapter 2, cryptically. In chapter 7, the images change because now there are four beasts, and the fourth beast is quite beastly, right? The first beast is a lion. An erect lion in chapter 7 that would correspond to the Babylonians. The second empire that crushes the Babylonian Empire is the Medo-Persian, a coalition of two kingdoms in which the Persians will transcend eventually the Medes. And that's described as a bear with ribs in its teeth, cartilage of the Babylonian Empire, a succession of kingdoms. And then there is this leper that has four heads. A leper is obviously a speedy beast. And that is Alexander the Great. But he dies at the age of 67, and his kingdom is divided to his four generals. Two of those generals are important to our story in biblical history, the Seleucids of Syria and the Ptolemies of Egypt. We all know Cleopatra. Hop, hop, hop. Now, and then after that comes an indescribable beast that we know as Rome. And the story is repeated. A stone uncut crushes, and God's kingdom comes. So we have a bright future, is what the text is saying. Now, when you come to Daniel chapter 8, another vision. So 2:6, 2:7, and 8 cover the same story, but with a different angle. The emphasis here is upon kingdom 2 and 3. And Daniel is just left saying, I don't know what's going on. we will know what went on retrospectively, but we know how it will end, right? So the emphasis here is upon the Persians and the Greeks. But it ends with a stone cut from heaven that crushes the kingdoms. Same story. So here we go. It's sort of beautiful. In the third year of Belshazzar, so he's Babylonian, it calls him king. But his father is really the reigning king. But he's all fighting wars, so he is king regent. A vision appeared to me. So now the shift is from third person, singular and plural, he and they, to I and we. So it's very personal. Appeared to me Daniel, subsequent to the one that appeared to me previously, the one in chapter 7, the three beasts. I looked in the vision, and while I was looking, I was in the citadel at Susa. Susa is in Elam, we would call it maybe Parthia. It's about 200 miles north and east of the capital of Babylon. So he's probably there on official business by this river, Ulai, which connects to the Tigris River. And that's the setting. So he is there, and here's the vision. And the chapter is very simple. It breaks into two parts, a vision and its interpretation. That's all it is. Then I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, a ram. Ooh, that had two horns, was standing in front of the canal. Now it's so far so good. So the ram would be the silver in the statue of chapter 2. It would be, let's see, it would be the bear standing with ribs in its mouth in chapter 7. Now it's a different description. I lifted my eyes, and a ram that had two horns was standing in front of the canal. Now, the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other. What's he describing? Two kingdoms, the Medes and the Persians, but the Persians will become the more dominant of the coalition. With the longer one coming up last, that's true. I saw the ram butting westward. Okay, what's the setting? He's looking into the future, but he's seeing the time of Esther and Xerxes, the Persians, okay, who have designs on conquering
What did I just do?
Greece,
Did
the Battle of Thermopylae. They are
you?
The Persians are crushed. But here's the image. I saw this ram, this metaphorical figure of a nation pushing westward into Europe. So we know that story. He was pushing westward, northward and
Going
southward. So
to
he's trying to extend his the great
okay,
kingdom.
talk something.
And no other beast could stand before him. He was really doing quite a good job. And no other beast could stand before him, nor was there anyone to rescue from his power, the Persians. But he did as he pleased and magnified himself. So standing on this canal in Elam, on near the Tigris River, Daniel has this vision. And the vision is this ram, a juggernaut nation pushing westward. But one horn is bigger than the other. Horn means strength, symbol of strength. While I was observing, behold, a male goat. Ah, this is exciting. What's the male goat? It's Greece.
Beautiful Guido in there.
Okay. So as the Persian Empire is trying to extend westward, Greece is pushing eastward, and they're going to clash. Okay. Now, while I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth
Hello.
without touching the ground. What
You
does that tell me? It tells me that it's fast moving,
the
swift. And if
king.
you look in the notes on page maybe two, I gave you a picture of a goat pushing toward the west. Daniel is seeing them, and this goat pushing with a large horn from the
Being
east
funny.
or toward the east.
Accepted
So far,
that.
so good. So in chapter seven, it would be the leper.
If you look in your notes
So
on
just
page
different animals
two,
in these visions. But he
no.
west, and no other beast could stand before him. Oh, I read that. And while he was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. He would conquer the world in 3.5 years. Alexander the Great is quite interesting. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between its eyes, meaning strength. He came up to the ram that had the two horns.
I
So he faces the Medes and the Persians,
think it's
which he
what
had seen standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in his mighty wrath. I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him, and he struck the ram and scattered his horns. So, as the Medes and the Persians
Window.
conquered Babylon in 539, now the Greeks are coming by 336, and they will conquer the Persians. Okay? So it's really a beautiful story. And if you look over on the next diagram in your notes, I gave you just a depiction of the conquering of Alexander the Great, the son of Philip the Macedon. He was trained philosophically by, I think, Aristotle. Now, so Alexander the Great, 3.5 years, conquers from Egypt to the Indus Valley in India. So we have a new world power on the scene. Nations come, nations go, I think is one story. But there is coming a kingdom that will have no end. That's the point. Now, verse 8, verse 7, I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him. And he struck the ram and scattered the horns. And the ram had no strength to withstand him. So we hurled him to the ground and trampled on him. And there was none to rescue the ram from his power. Okay? So we have gone from the rising power of the Babylonians in 605 that will end in 539 to be a short length, great empire. And after that, the Persians, 536 all the way to 323, to be crushed by the Greeks. That's where we are. So it's a little bit of world history. Now, then the male goat magnified himself. So whenever I read this, I think of Muhammad Ali. I am the greatest. Well, he was, but duration doesn't belong to humanity, right? He hurled him. No, I'm sorry. Then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly, but as soon as he was mighty, I thought of we think of Adolf Hitler as one of the great butchers of the last century, but there was a greater one. His name was Joe Stalin. Joe Stalin took out 22 million of his own people. And he was coming after the Jews in 1952 on the day of Passover of the Jews. It sounds like the Book of Esther. Joe Stalin had a heart attack and died. Right. So who is governing the affairs of men? I think someone who is invisible. So far, so good. And now you and I live in the atomic age, and I'm reading a book, biography of J. Robert Oppenheimer and Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg, who created a ability of self-destruction unknown to mankind. And after they made it and used it on August 6th and August 9th, 1945, they ponder the ethics of it. Right? It's sort of one to think about. Then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly. This is Alexander the great conqueror. I figured if this man could conquer the world in 3.5 years, but he died of typhoid fever, maybe malaria. But as soon as he was mighty, a large horn, the large horn was broken, his power. And in its place, there came up four horns toward the four winds of heaven. For the kingdom is divided into four parts. Okay? In biblical history, intertestamental history, two are important. Of his generals, both become quite powerful, the Ptolemies of Egypt and the Seleucids of Syria, and they hate each other. They're always fighting each other, and every time they fight, they walk right over the returning exiles. Okay, now out of one of them, one of these four, came forth a rather small horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, the east, and the beautiful land. Who is that? Syria. The Seleucids, the beautiful land. Daniel just can't grasp this. It grew up to the host of heaven and caused some of the host and some of the stars to fall to the earth. It's a triumph, image of triumph. And it trampled them down. Hoo-hoo. So far, so good. It even magnified itself. Who is this guy? We know. His name is Antiochus Epiphanes. We know when he reigned. He reigned from 174 to 168. Okay. It even magnified itself to be equal with the commander of hosts. And it removed the regular sacrifices from him. What's happening? Okay, simple story. I think the picture is over on page. Well, my pages are different, but it shows the Antiochus. It's the last picture. Antiochus and a struggle with the Ptolemies. It's called the Sixth Syro-Egyptian War. So these four generals, two of these generals, want to defeat each other. One is Ptolemaic, and the other is Seleucid Syria. Every time one army moves against the other, they trample over what is called the Beautiful Land. In the Sixth Syro-Egyptian War, sixth war between these two nations, something magical happens. This is really breathtaking. Antiochus Epiphanes almost conquers Egypt. This is the year is 166 when he's on the brink of defeating the Ptolemies, defeating the Egyptians. Something happens. The Romans show up. So this fourth empire from the west is now beginning to cast its shadow in the east. It's called the ships of Katim. They came from Cyprus, a Roman military. And if the story is correct in the Book of Maccabees, the Roman general confronted Antiochus Epiphanes, took a sword and drew a circle around Antiochus, and said to him, "You have two choices. Step out of the circle and go back to your homeland, or step out of the circle and die." So what happened? Antiochus realizes that there's a new emerging world power, and they are connected. Mark Antony, Cleopatra, they are connected to the Ptolemies. So now the border of the Seleucids is distressed. What are you going to do? He does this simple. He fortifies Israel into a Hellenistic Syrian state. What does he actually do? He murders several, 100 and some priests in Jerusalem. He desecrates the temple by offering a pig every year on his birthday on the altar. In other words, he's trying to make the Jewish people his buffer from Egypt. And then he erects in the place of what was the Holy of Holies, an idol called Zeus. What happened? What did the Jewish people do? This is a great story. They rebelled. They rebelled against one of the mightiest empires in the world, Syria. They had the advantage of a new technique. Jews seem to have it. It's called the elephant. And they gained their sovereignty. They defeated the Syrians. They cleansed the temple. The feast is called Hanukkah, Feast of Lights. Why? Because when the Maccabees, Judas Maccabee, came into the temple to cleanse it, they found only enough holy oil to last a day to light the great menorah. But it lasted 8 days. So it's a non-biblical feast of the Jewish people to this day. And they're celebrating their deliverance from a shadowed figure of the Antichrist, Antiochus Epiphanes. And the nation is reborn. Can a nation be born again? And it will last 100 years until the coming of Pompey, the Roman, and they'll be crushed and their temple destroyed in 70 AD. So far, so good. So it's very simple. He is seeing a vision of a ram, this mighty Persian Empire extending its boundaries westward. He clashes with this ram with a big horn, pushing eastward. The ram is destroyed. Alexander the Great conquers the world. But he dies in Egypt, and his kingdom is divided to his four generals. Two are important, the Seleucids of Syria and the Ptolemies of Egypt. And they're in constant conflict for hegemony, destroying the other. In the sixth war between the two, under Antiochus Epiphanes. So Antiochus is a picture of the Antichrist. There's many shadows that appear before the big one, right? And we've had a few in our lifetime. Now, fearing the coming of the Romans, Antiochus then makes a Hellenistic buffer state out of the land of Palestine. When he desecrates the temple, it precipitates a war against all odds that the Jews win and the nation's reborn. Okay, so here we go. Now it gets fun. Here's the interpretation. Let's see, verse 12. And on account of the transgressions of the host will be given over to the horn along with the regular sacrifice. It will fling truth to the ground and perform its will and prosper. Then I heard a holy one saying, speaking, and another holy one said to that particular one, how long will this vision, will the vision about the regular sacrifice apply? While the transgression causes horror, so as to allow the both the holy place and the host to be trampled. How long is the temple going to be desecrated by the Syrians? And he said to me, 2,300 evenings and mornings. How do we interpret that? I think you interpret it in Jewish reckoning by the fact that evening and morning was considered a day. Okay? Genesis 1:5. When God created light, it says the evening and the morning were the first day. Okay, so Jewish Sabbath begins at twilight on Friday evening and ends at sunset on Saturday. Evening, morning, one day. That would be 3.5 years. If the temple was desecrated in 167, it was liberated, we know, in 164, 3.5 years. Okay. I think you walk away from prophecy by saying, if you look at the big picture, it's stunning. If you look at the details, you will get confused. So always look for the big picture. And the big picture is called hope. Monarchs will come and go. We get rid of one, two of the cousins will show up. And that's the story of mankind, right? But there's coming one that will end it all. Then I, Daniel, had seen the vision. I sought to understand it. Behold, a man was standing before me, one who looked like a man. Who is that guy? I think it's Christ. Why? Because he gives command to an angel. And I heard the voice of a man between the banks of the Ulai, and he called out and said, Gabriel, give this man an understanding of the vision. Tell him what it means. So if Gabriel is an archangel, he is taking instruction from one who is above him, right? So he came near to where I was standing, and when he came, I was frightened. Well, I would be too. Fell on my face, and he said to me, "Son of man, understand that the vision pertains to the end of time. It's beyond your time." Right? So after Daniel's time, the Persians will come to power. They're already there. He died in the third year of Cyrus. And after him, the Greeks will come to power. And after him, the Romans will come to power. And after the Romans, a stone made without hands will crush geopolitical powers. And a real kingdom will come. Right? Now, then he tells us, the ram you saw with the two horns represents Media and Persia. So we got that straight. That's done. The shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece. And the large horn that is between his eyes is the first king, Alexander. So far, so good. It's very precise. The broken horn, Alexander, and the four horns that arose in its place represent four kingdoms. Exactly. Four, they divided the great Greek Empire into four parts. Right? In the latter period of these four, of their rule, when transgressors have run their course, a king will arise. Who is the king? It's Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth, who is a shadow of the Antichrist that will come in our day or someday. A king will arise, insolent, skilled in intrigue. This guy's going to really be a hubba hubba. His power will be mighty. So Daniel is being told that Assyrian is going to rise. And he will destroy in an extraordinary degree. He's going to wipe out the temple, put Zeus in its place, kill its priests, and will cause the seat to succeed by his influence. So, what we have marching across the page of history are shadows. Alexander the Great's a shadow. Antiochus is a shadow. Pol Pot was a shadow. Adolf Hitler was a shadow. And just so was Joe Stalin. And I could name some more. But they march and they fade. But one more is coming. He only lasts 3.5 years. Isn't that an interesting amount of time? And through his shrewdness, he will dis and will cause deceit to succeed by his influence. Oh, that's Antiochus, but that's somebody else. He will magnify himself in his heart. He will destroy many while they are at ease. And he will even oppose the prince of princes. All right? That's the man of sin, the Antichrist. But notice this little phrase. So I think this, everything that happens in life is a picture of one of two things. If it's negative, I always say or think in my little mind, this is a shadow of hell that by the grace of God, I will never experience. And everything good that happens, I always say, this is a picture, a shadowed picture of heaven. And things will even get better than this. So far, so good. Ah, that's why the Bible is so relevant to every generation. Shadows. But he, this is the key phrase. This is, so I take its primary meaning is Antiochus will be crushed by the Romans. But I also take it as a shadow looking forward to the Antichrist because of this verse. But he will be broken, the Antichrist, without human agency. So the stone cut in chapter 2 that crushes the image of Nebuchadnezzar, crushing the 10 toes, is repeated. The end of time. Okay, so it's a very simple story. The vision of the evenings and the mornings, which has been told, Daniel says, is true. Or the angel says, but keep the vision a secret. Don't tell anybody. For it pertains to many days in the future. So far, so good. Now, here's poor Daniel. I like this verse. Then I, Daniel, was exhausted. Finally, in chapter 12, God is going to tell Daniel, go away. Don't bother. It's too much for you. And sick for days. Then I got up and carried out the king's business. That's why he was there. But I was astonished at the vision, and there was none to explain it. Right? And I think what troubles the dear man is that with the return of the people to the land, he thought the kingdom would come. But now he hears about armies coming and crushing the land. Right? He just can't put A and B together. In retrospect, we can do that. So what do I carry away from this story, if I can find it? I may not be able to. I think one thing strikes me is that everything is under control. We may not like it and we may not understand it, but a lack of understanding has been repeated by the people of God over time. So when you don't really understand, what do? You trust a person of integrity. We have not met one in human history, right? But one is coming, a stone cut from heaven without hands. Kingdoms come and go. The comfort in our passage to me is this. Though troubles arise, you and I have a brilliant future. Right? When will the stone cut from heaven descend and time will be no more? Beats me. Right? I don't know what's out there, but I know who is coming. Now, the purpose of God in revealing the future should not allow us to quibble or fracture over the meaning and chronology of details. It is given to us to encourage us to press on. That's the purpose of history, right? I often hear my students say to me, you know, I hope the Lord comes soon because I don't want to take your exam. I find that valid, but I find the motive terrible. And I find their reason for living terrible. The goal is not to escape anything. That's not our hope. Our hope is in a person who's coming, who's going to write the last chapter of the book of history. Right? Shall I be carried through the skies, through Audiencias, through flowery beds of ease? While others fought to win the prize and sailed through bloody seas. No. Right? So far, so good. We're not escapists. We are believers that the King of Kings will someday create a world beyond our imagination, where there's no more sun and no more moon, no more stars, because Revelation says he will be among his people who is light. Right? So when I look up at the sun, I think there's a shadowed picture of true light. Right? It will set, but true light will never set on his people. Right? Isn't that pretty? Okay, time for a question. This was a hard chapter, but it's just the Persians are going to go, the Greeks are going to go, Rome is going to come, but God will have the last say.
Why do you think that he said, don't tell anybody?
I think he was just mystified. It'd be clear in chapter 12. He's going to tell him, you can't understand these things. In other words, prophecy is retrospective. It is not, you only understand it after it's over. And I think when I get to heaven, I'm going to say to the Lord, oh my gracious, that's what it means. I hope the friends I disagreed with aren't here. Okay. We may miss out on chronology, but we don't miss out on a person, and he's the important thing. We want to be faithful to Holy Scripture, and the Holy Scriptures tell us that our times are safely in his hands. And there's a purpose in it all. Right? I believe when God draws the last person for whom Christ died, there'll be no reason for time, because the purpose of time is to gather a people to love him. Right? So far, so good.
John, excuse me.
Yes.
Is there any, I understand what you're saying about history gives us a reason to push on or tells us to push on, but is there any significance or meaning to Daniel's dream and visions appearing, talking about the conquering empires and appearing to stop at Rome? About Germany, Russia?
Yeah, Rome, they're just toes on the darn iron end of the statue of chapter 2. The Roman Empire began with Rome, and it's still here. Gentiles dominating the world. So it's the time of the Gentiles, right? It began with Babylon when they conquered the ancient people. It will end when the stone cut from heaven conquers them. We are in the Roman Empire, right? So far, so good. Now, Daniel wouldn't know that, but we may be wrong, but we could be right, because there's no other alternative with what we know right now. Right? We may screw the details, but we're not the person. And that's it. History is not going to end with the tears that may fill our eyes. It's going to end with the presence of God among his people. In creation, he came first, but sun, moon, and stars came on the fourth day, because he came into time. The tabernacle, the presence of God among his people. But God doesn't dwell in sticks and stones. He dwells in our hearts. The true temple of God. Right? And we'll be with him forever. We know that. One more?
Yeah. Good morning, John. Thank you for this lesson. But it's so deep, and it just sort of tips on the perplexity and the complexity of the times that the church is in right now. And I sometimes feel as I have to stay closer to the cross than listening to what's in the world. And my thought is that the church should be really fulfilling the purpose of God in demonstrating pure love, his love, not our love, his love at this time.
Oh, I'll read the first page of the Dallas Morning News. Um, I think we're living in the last days. I really do. As a historian watching the 13th century become the 21st century, it just didn't happen yesterday. It has been in the happening since the rise of the Renaissance. God may be drawing us to the end of time. I don't know that, but it's what Luther said. Luther said, if I knew the Lord was coming tomorrow, but today he wanted me to plant an oak tree, what would I do my last day? Luther said, I'd plant the oak tree. What was he really saying? Obedience is better than panic. Do what's right. Do what's right. And the Lord will sort it all out. Right? That's the beauty, I think, of the gospel. But I do think, as a historian, but I'm getting old and they tend to get pessimistic. And I'm not pessimistic, but all that. But I think I don't know how it can go on with the downward spiral that it's taking, because when people abuse their freedom in the name of freedom, it leads to totalitarianism to keep them in check. And totalitarianism always leads to anarchy, where people are willing to give up their freedoms for momentary peace, which is no peace at all. So we're really watching it. We're in a very great day, I think. We just don't know when. But we do know that this stone is going to crush the toes of Daniel's image. And we will be with him forever, right? I know what we should do. We should live normal lives. Don't panic. Don't store food, right? No need for that. It's better to die for the right cause than live for a wrong one. Right? That's the way it is. That's why we have each other, right? We love each other. It's going to get worse when we get to chapter 9. But it's the same thing. I always tell the student, I got to quit. I always tell the student, look, if you came not knowing the gospel, you have come to the wrong school. So if you already know the gospel and you know the implications for your life, why in the heck did you come here? The answer is this. The story is simple. We're going to teach you how to say the same story 30,000 different ways so you can have a long ministry. Well, we'll pray. Lord, thanks for being together as friends. Thank you for Daniel, and that though he feared, for he didn't understand, we find ourselves often the same way. We don't understand. And when we don't understand, we've been taught to flee to you, for you have the whole world in your hands, and you are directing it for divine purpose and glory. And we trust you. We love you. You gave us your son. And he who would not spare his own son, would he not freely give us all things? And unto that end, we give you praise in Jesus' name. Amen.